and an anti-immigrant movement. Know-Nothing supported anti-slavery, missionary projects at home and abroad, charitable aid for orphans and the poor, and temperance. They also despised the new immigrants, especially the Irish, for their rum and Romanism. The Know-Nothing platform called for slavery restriction, alcohol prohibition, a halt to immigration, and a law banning immigrants from benefiting from the Homestead Act, which made cheap land available to settlers moving west. The immigrants, for their part, hated the Know-Nothings. The Irish, in particular, associated them with the same English Protestants who had been oppressing them back in Ireland. We have already seen how the Democratic Party had been organized by the Van Burenites in the North to recruit Irish and other immigrants to the urban machines. Even though the immigrants were clearly being exploited by the Democrats, this was exploitation with their consent. So the immigrants identified with the Democrats, and the Know-Nothings identified first with the Whigs, and then with their own American Party. By 1860, this American Party had dissolved, but the underlying movement had not. It still counted upwards of a million supporters. Given the association of the Irish and other immigrants with the Democratic Party, the Know-Nothings were naturally disposed to vote for the opposing party. This made them potential Republican voters who, in a close election, could easily make the difference. Lincoln knew he needed the votes of these Know-Nothings if the Republican Party was to prevail in that critical year. Throughout the 1850s, the Democratic stalwart Stephen Douglas had repeatedly and vociferously castigated the Know-Nothing movement, branding its followers a bunch of ignorant xenophobes. Douglas did not hesitate to do this, even when the Know-Nothing movement was at its zenith in the mid-1850s. Lincoln, by contrast, made no such condemnations. He recognized that the nativist movement, despite its malevolent elements, was part of the anti-slavery movement, and he had no intention of dividing the forces of the anti-slavery movement. During the 1860 campaign, Democrats circulated a rumor that Lincoln had made a secret stop at a Know-Nothing lodge in Quincy, Massachusetts. The issue was all over the papers, and Abram Jones, a Jewish Republican attorney in Quincy who detested the Know-Nothings, wrote to Lincoln to ask if it were true. Lincoln responded that it was not, but then added this: "And now a word of caution. Our adversaries think that they can gain a point if they could force me to openly deny the charge, by which some degree of offense would be given to the Americans. For this reason, it must not publicly appear that I am paying any attention to the charge." In private, Lincoln made his position clear in an 1855 letter to his friend Joshua Speed. "I am not a Know-Nothing. That is certain. How could I be? How can anyone who abhors the oppression of Negroes be in favor of degrading classes of white people? As a nation, we began by declaring that all men are created equal. We now practically read it, all men are created equal except Negroes. When the Know-Nothings get control, it will read, all men are created equal except Negroes and foreigners and Catholics. When it comes to this, I should prefer emigrating to some country where they make no pretense of loving liberty, to Russia, for instance, where despotism can be taken pure without the base alloy of hypocrisy." It should also be said that leading Republicans like Frederick Douglass rejected the Know-Nothing agenda and embraced the immigrants. Likening hatred for the Chinese to hatred for blacks, Douglass said, "I want a home here not only for the Negro, the mulatto, and the Latin races, but I want the Asiatic to find a home here in the United States and feel at home here, both for his sake and for ours." The Republican platform in 1860 contained no denunciation of immigrants, no call for restricted immigration, and no support for excluding immigrants from the provisions of the Homestead Act. Even so, Lincoln's only denunciation of anti-foreign and anti-Catholic prejudice appears in a personal private letter. Lincoln never publicly repudiated the Know-Nothings. For this, he was assailed by Democratic newspapers, just as Trump was assailed in the progressive media for not sufficiently repudiating the white nationalists in Charlottesville. And Lincoln got the Know-Nothing vote, just as we can reasonably surmise Trump got the white nationalist vote. Lincoln never expressed guilt or qualms over this. From his point of view, the know-nothings came to him. He didn't go over to them. Moreover, in rejecting the bad elements of the know-nothings, such as the hatred of immigrants and determination to shut America's door to them, he did not hesitate to identify with the good things they stood for, such as social reform, temperance, and anti-slavery. In this episode, if we think about it, there is a valuable lesson for Trump and the Republican Party. The Obama-Trump voter. Now we turn to Coates' charge that Trump got to the White House through a successful appeal to whiteness or white supremacy. Progressives like Coates interpret Trump's campaign slogan, Make America Great Again, as a call to return America to a time and place where women were out of the workforce, blacks were segregated and discriminated against, Hispanics and Asians were barred from coming to America, and gays were a silent group confined to the closet. Admittedly, Trump never said any of this, but might his voters understand him to be saying, or at least implying, it? More than 18 months into Trump's presidency, scholars have crunched the numbers to figure out which voters gave him his margin of victory. The consensus holds that Trump did not win by getting out his vote, nor did Hillary lose by failing to get out her vote. Base voters of both parties showed up to vote for their candidate. American presidential elections are typically decided by the independent or swing voter, who is captive to neither party, and Trump prevailed by winning a sufficient number of these voters in key states. In 2008 and 2012, these independent voters pulled the lever for Obama. In the 2016 Democratic primary, many of these same voters were for Bernie Sanders. So Trump won by getting Obama voters and Sanders voters. This is confirmed by the fact that Trump won blue states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Obama won all those states, even while Hillary had regarded Wisconsin as so securely in the bag that she didn't even bother to campaign there. Consider Youngstown, Ohio, which is regarded as America's prototypical working-class town. This is Union territory, so heavily Democratic that Republicans often don't field candidates in many races and think they have done well when they get one-third of the vote. Bruce Springsteen wrote a song about a father who returns to Youngstown after World War II to work in the steel mills. But now the yard's just scrap and rubble. Them big boys did what Hitler couldn't do. Translation? America used to be great, but isn't anymore. The evil corporate bosses have ruined it. Youngstown is in Mahoning County, and Mahoning, together with adjoining Trumbull County, gave Obama the margin he needed to win Ohio in 2008 and 2012. No one thought these voters would switch parties. In the words of columnist Paul Strasek, it would be like asking a New York Yankees fan to cheer for the Boston Red Sox. Yet Trump almost took Mahoning County. Hillary won it by a hair, and he did win in Trumbull County. His promise to make America great again seems to have resonated. In Wisconsin, Trump won 21 working-class counties that just 4 years earlier had gone to Obama by comfortable margins. Howard County, Iowa, which is 150 miles northeast of Des Moines, went for Obama by a margin of 20 points. In 2012, in a massive swing, Trump won it by 20 points. Maine's 2nd Congressional District, which Obama won by 8 points, went for Trump by 12. Of nearly 700 counties that twice voted for Obama, more than 200 defected to Trump. Who are these voters? They are white voters. We can call them Bruce Springsteen voters. And we can safely dismiss the idea that they are white supremacists. White supremacists don't vote for a black presidential candidate, however well qualified. Nor was Obama well qualified. He was a community organizer who had not yet served a single term in the Senate. Clearly, Obama's skin color did not prevent these swing voters from going over to his side. The website 538.com examined what happened in Howard County, Iowa. Laura Hupka, Navy veteran and ultrasound technician who chaired the county's Democratic Party and knocked on doors for Hillary, shared her perspective on why Democratic voters switched to Trump. We are a blue-collar town. People who were longtime supporters didn't want to hear what we had to say anymore. As for Hillary, she was an elitist, was what I kept hearing. Holly Rasmussen, an Obama voter, admitted she ended up voting for Trump. Just to shake up Washington, to be honest. We've been in a rut for so long. People here don't want to be multi-gazillionaires. They just want to get paid a decent wage. Before casting her ballot, Rasmussen went to see a movie that exposed the history of the Democratic Party. Quoting 538.com, "The week before the election, emboldened Trump supporters took out a full-page newspaper ad and rented out the historic city-owned Cresto Theater and Opera House, a long-ago vaudeville haunt, for screenings of conservative filmmaker Dinesh D'Souza's documentary Hillary's America and the Benghazi film 13 Hours. To Democrats' dismay, the theater was packed. I may have helped, but in the end it was Trump's message that got through. A few weeks before the election, CNN's Van Jones interviewed Scott Seitz of Trumbull County, Ohio, another lifelong Democrat and Obama voter who flipped to Trump. We put Democrats in office, he said, and they turned around and forgot completely about us. We have a ton of mills that seem to close up, and not only did they close up, but they've been torn down and removed. They look like ghost towns. We truly want to make America better. We hope the bleeding can actually stop in our area. When we get a downturn in the economy, we still need to feed our families. And when they talk about the Second Amendment or taking our guns away, that's exactly what we think of all the time. We have hunting together and as a family, and we go out and we harvest and we put food in the freezer." Do these sound like people who are trying to force women out of the workforce or to reestablish segregation and state-sponsored discrimination or to send immigrants like me home? These may be Democrats, but they are not those types of Democrats. Outraged at the defection of these voters to Trump, progressives have concocted a narrative designed to discredit them, but it is maliciously false, just another big lie. What the hillbillies figured out. We have so far an indication of why working-class Obama voters pivoted to Trump. But we need to probe deeper, because we also have to answer Ta-Nehisi Coates' question, why didn't the white working class follow the black working class and the Hispanic working class in opting for the Democratic plantation? In other words, what differentiates the white workers from their black and Latino counterparts? Let's begin with a bit of white history. I realize this sounds strange because we are accustomed to hearing about black history and Hispanic history, but the white working class has a history too, albeit one that is typically ignored in progressive scholarship. Progressives won't tell you, for example, that historically whites around the world have been enslaved in numbers comparable to blacks. The Roman slaves, for example, were mostly whites, and over the centuries, several million whites were captured and enslaved by the various Muslim dynasties from the Abbasid to the Ottoman. Indeed, the very term slave derives from the Latin word for Slav, a reference to the large number of white slaves captured from that region of Central Europe. Nancy Eisenberg's recent book, White Trash, offers a useful account of the history of white workers in America. Their ancestors, she points out, were the dregs of Europe, cast off to clean out the continent and also to do the dirty work that needed to be done in the New World. These early settlers, in Eisenberg's account, included roguish highwaymen, mean vagrants, Irish rebels, known whores, and an assortment of convicts, including an English waif named Bess Armstrong, dispatched to Virginia for stealing two spoons. Although not slaves themselves, Eisenberg portrays the crackers and squatters of Virginia and North Carolina as very much in the same low category. In theory, indentured servants were captives merely for a fixed period, usually between 4 to 9 years, most typically 7. But during this period, Don Jordan and Michael Walsh write in White Cargo, masters had more or less total control over their destiny. And servants soon discovered that for relatively minor offenses, including attempts to run away, their terms could be extended. In fact, planters employed these lowly whites to work in gangs alongside slaves, with the same overseer driving the whole operation, with the authority to flog the whites no less than the blacks. The lives of white workers, historian David Bryan Davis writes, were not significantly different from the lives of most slaves. Sometimes planters gave the riskiest tasks to whites, knowing that if they were injured or killed, there would be no price to pay. The whites were wage laborers, after all, while the slaves cost close to $1,000 apiece in the early to mid-19th century. The term white trash made its first appearance in print in this period in 1831. But here Eisenberg goes astray because she focuses too narrowly on the poor whites of the South, flaying them for their racist condescension toward black slaves without calling out the Democratic Party that cultivated these sentiments for political gain. Eisenberg implies that today's Trump voters are the descendants of those racist white Southerners. This, however, is clearly wrong. The white working voters that delivered the election to Trump in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin are obviously descended from ancestors who fought on the Union side in the Civil War. Even the poorest of poor whites in the South, the Appalachians, were mostly independent-minded folk who resisted the demand for secession. When the white hillbillies of Virginia refused to join the Confederacy, Lincoln carved out a new state for them, West Virginia, which remained in the Union. So much for history. Fast forward now to the second half of the 20th century. In the post-war period, the manufacturing boom across America, especially in the Northeast and Midwest, raised the standard of living of the white working class to the point where a blue-collar plumber or electrician had the same middle-class amenities as his college-educated white counterpart. The third quarter of the 20th century was, one might say, the golden age of the white working class. Not that this group experienced the meteoric rise in earnings that college-educated whites saw, especially in professions like medicine, finance, business, law, and later technology. But working-class whites could expect to see a gradual improvement in wages from a couple of dollars an hour in the early 1950s to $20 an hour or more in the 1970s. Adjusted for inflation, this represents a doubling of real annual income for working-class households. The annual increases may have been small, but at least the jobs were stable and the trajectory was upward. With a comfortable and steady wage, whites built working-class communities where young people expected to follow in the path of their parents. Their lives were not defined by moving up and moving out, nor by the need for creative self-expression. Rather, these people found solace in staying put, devoting themselves to providing for their families and earning respect not only through their skilled trades, but also through the involvement in the civic life of the community by becoming, say, volunteer firemen or little league coaches. Today, many of those working-class communities have been obliterated. The high-paying jobs are gone, replaced by service jobs that don't pay enough to comfortably provide for a family. Young people can no longer do what their parents did. They can stay with much more dismal prospects, or they can leave. The disappearance of jobs doesn't merely reflect a contraction of opportunity. Rather, it reflects a breakdown of community. Even the family and civic associations that contributed to a decent life for these people have frayed and corroded. In other words, the economic catastrophe of the white working class is now accompanied by a cultural catastrophe. Some of the same cultural pathologies that were once characteristic of black America are now also part of white America. In the mid-60s, for example, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, in a famous report, The Negro Family, A Case for National Action, declared a national crisis over the fact that the black illegitimacy rate was approaching 25%. But today, the white illegitimacy rate is over 25%. Just as crack has ravaged the black inner city, white communities have been devastated by a drug and alcohol epidemic that seems to have affected adults and young people alike. White working class areas have seen rising rates of depression, cirrhosis of the liver, and suicide. So serious are these problems that, according to a study by Ann Case and Angus Deaton, working-class whites, who at the turn of the century had a mortality rate 30% lower than blacks, now have a mortality rate 30% higher than blacks. I make this comparison not to make a racial point. On the contrary, one can infer from these pathologies and their prevalence in white, black, and Latino communities that there is nothing racial about them. Rather, they are the product of dwindling prospects and the cultural dysfunction that often comes in their wake. Rather, my point is simply that the white working class now has the highest rate of premature deaths in the country. Case and Deaton chillingly term these deaths of despair. J.D. Vance's recent book, Hillbilly Elegies, gives as good an account as can be given of what it actually feels like to grow up in these ravaged communities. Vance's own mother is addicted to drugs and moves serially from one marriage to another, five at last count, which is why he was raised by his grandparents, whom he calls, hillbilly style, Moomaw and Papaw. Moomaw and Papaw have their own problems, Papaw being known to get rip-roaring drunk and deliver some heavy blows to his wife, and Moomaw in retaliation to set the old man on fire while he is asleep. Yet young Vance somehow manages to get out of all this insanity, to get a decent education, eventually to make his way to Yale Law School, and to his current job at an investment firm in San Francisco, not to mention his part-time vocation as a successful writer. How did he do it? He attributes part of his success to his crazy-ass grandparents, who for all their eccentricities loved him unconditionally, and to the Marine Corps, which taught him to stop blaming his failures on society and to start taking responsibility like a man. When Vance traveled abroad on a Marine Corps mission, he encountered children in third world countries who didn't have a fraction of what he did. He handed one such kid an eraser, just an eraser, and witnessed the child respond as though he had been handed the moon. This episode and others like it taught Vance not to see himself as a victim, but rather, as he puts it, one lucky son of a bitch. Vance learned to appreciate not his white privilege, but rather his American privilege, his good fortune to be born and raised in the United States of America. Like voting for his dad. What can we conclude from all this? First, I conclude that while the working class is still not in as bad shape as the black and Hispanic working class, its travails are no less hard to bear because they represent a sharp reversal of fortune. These white working class communities once prospered, but now they are in ruins. Suffering is always harder to bear when it represents a steep fall from the way things used to be. The white working class seems to be the first generation in post-war American history to experience downward mobility in this way. At the same time, it has not escaped the notice of the white working class that the Democratic Party reserves all its attention and sympathy for black and Latino suffering and none for white suffering. On the contrary, progressive Democrats portray poor whites as racists who refuse to recognize their ongoing white privilege. Many working-class whites are hostile to Democrats, not because they are racist, but because they feel discriminated against, and in my opinion, they are right to feel this way. Second, the white working class remains as ornery, rebellious, and independent-minded as it always was. It hasn't given in. It hasn't thrown in the towel. The Democrats have succeeded in convincing a large portion of working-class blacks and Latinos that they are better off on the urban plantation, living off the government and delivering their votes in exchange to the party that makes that happen. And the Democrats would like nothing better than to dump the white working class there as well. Some working-class whites have, of course, fallen for this con, which is why they are Democrats. But a sufficiently large number of them continue to view the Democratic plantation as a degradation and an insult. They are down, but they are not yet out. They may not have jobs, but they still have a work ethic. Their families and communities may be hurting, but they still want to pull them together. They can see what has happened to their black and Latino counterparts on the plantation. Their plight is, if anything, considerably worse. So, tempted though they may be with the promise of free stuff, they are not about to become leeches off the state. Their stubborn attitude can be compared to the Spartans, whose land was sometimes called Laconia. As the story goes, when Philip of Macedon contemplated an invasion, he sent a message to the Spartan ephors that said, "If I take Laconia, I will kill all the men, rape all the women, and enslave all the children, leaving no stone on top of another." To which the Spartans replied with a single word, "If." And this is the attitude of white working class rebels. They may be surrounded by all sorts of perils, but they are not done yet. So why Trump? When they hear Trump to make America great again, what they hear is that he cares about their plight and that he will try to make their communities whole. Let's pause to consider the three forces that have combined to create this perfect storm of devastation across working class America. These forces are globalization, immigration, and technology. Jobs go abroad via one-sided trade agreements, immigrants come here and work for less, and technology puts machines to work doing what humans used to be required to do. Now ask yourself, what has the Democratic Party done to address these problems? Answer, nothing. And the GOP record is not much better. Both parties, of course, are reconciled to modern technology. Both parties have in general welcomed globalization, allowing other countries to freely sell here, even though they impose tariffs on American goods sold there. Finally, both parties have ignored the problem of illegal immigration, the Democrats largely because they want illegals on their plantation, the Republicans to appease their business constituency, which can get away with paying these people lower wages. Trump, by contrast, refused to sign the Pacific Trade Treaty in its extant form. He vowed to reconsider the North American Free Trade Agreement, and to the consternation of many Republicans wedded to free trade dogma, he imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum, 25% on steel, 10% on aluminum, exempting only Canada and Mexico, pending what Trump said was a fair rebalancing of existing trade agreements with those countries. Trump also put the immigration issue on the map, forcing both parties to confront the impact of illegals on jobs, on crime and security, and on the burden placed on scarce social services. Trump has even suggested the need to reform legal immigration, placing more emphasis on merit and on workers this country needs, and less on the kind of chain migration that allows an immigrant like me to bring virtually limitless numbers of relatives to this country under the pretext of family unification. In sum, while the Democrats do nothing and the Republicans do next to nothing, Trump at least promises to try. I have never heard Trump say he knows how to restore these working-class communities, but I have never seen any other politician address the issue with Trump's forthrightness. And since his election, Trump has been on it, cajoling and muscling corporations to bring their businesses and jobs back to the United States, and a number of them have. Fiat Chrysler, for example, said it would shift production of heavy trucks from Mexico to a plant in Warren, Michigan. Toyota and Mazda announced the opening of a new $1.6 billion plant in Huntsville, Alabama, that will create 4,000 jobs over 3 years. Apple and ExxonMobil pledged to expand their operations in the United States. Trump's solutions have been decried by Democrats and even some Republicans as trivial and ad hoc, but however inadequate they are, he is the only one attempting a cure. Recall the stony-faced silence with which Democrats, notably the Black Caucus, greeted Trump's announcement in his 2018 State of the Union that black unemployment rates had plummeted. Trump was right about this. The black unemployment rate dipped from 8.3% when Trump took office to 6.8% a year later. One might expect this to be welcome news to a group that purports to champion black welfare. Yet upon reflection, there is no puzzle here. The black caucus is part of the overseer class. These guys don't want people to leave the plantation. The Trump voters certainly get it. I remember watching a working class guy being interviewed on CNN shortly after the election. What he said was not what CNN wanted to hear. Trump, he said, reminded him of his own father, who had worked blue-collar jobs all his life, only to see that way of life essentially wiped out. Not because he got lazy or stopped playing by the rules, but because of decisions made by other people, by politicians and technocrats, acting very much in their own self-interest. I don't know if Trump will change anything, the man said, breaking down and holding back tears, and I don't really care if he does. He is the only one who spoke to my dad's broken heart. My dad is now gone, but when I vote for Trump, it was like voting for my dad. Elephant in the living room. I believe I have vindicated Trump voters of the charge that they are all a bunch of white supremacists. Still, there are white supremacists in America. There are neo-Nazis and Ku Klux Klansmen and skinheads, the very people who showed up in Charlottesville for the Unite the Right rally. There are Richard Spencer and his cohorts performing Hitler-esque Trump salutes. If fascism and racism are, as I have shown throughout this book, phenomena of the progressive Democrats, why are these guys on the right? How to explain their support for Trump? This is the elephant in the living room. First, it should be noted that this is a very small group. The KKK today is virtually a defunct organization. It has been defunct since the 1980s. It has at most a few hundred members nationwide. If the Klan were to organize a rally anywhere in the country, its members would be overwhelmed by a much larger group of counter-protesters. And no, the KKK doesn't have a real newspaper. The Crusader, the so-called newspaper that praised Trump, is nothing more than a crude 12-page pamphlet that comes out four times a year. Historian David Chalmers, whose book Hooded Americanism is a history of the Klan, is frequently asked by reporters to explain the KKK revival. He tells them that they are the Klan revival. In other words, there is no revival except in their fevered reporting. Chalmers even recounts an episode in which a KKK cross-burning was held up until the TV crews arrived. The left-wing media needs the Klan to sustain their political attack on the right. So they magnify the organization, allowing the public to believe that it still poses the kind of threat that it historically posed under the aegis of the Democratic Party to blacks and other minorities. Let's assume that the Klan has 500 to 1,000 members. What's the evidence that these guys voted for Trump? Actually, there is none. The media loves to trot out former Klansman David Duke, not because he's representative of anything, but because he's the only prominent name associated with the Klan that can be tied to the Republicans, notwithstanding the GOP's insistent repudiation of him on numerous occasions. It is hard to name anyone else, because historically, the entire leadership of the KKK, Imperial Wizards, Grand Dragons, Exalted Cyclopses, Grand Kleagles, and all have all been Democrats. Has anyone conducted a survey of neo-Nazis or skinheads to show that they are actually Trump voters? I'm not aware of any. When CNN commentator Van Jones was asked by conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt what percentage of Trump voters are white supremacists, he replied, probably less than 1%. Columnist Will Salatan invoked an opinion survey to show that while 3% of whites said they mostly agree with the white supremacy movement, 5% of Trump voters fell into this category. So the data are scarce and all over the place. What we can agree on is that we are dealing with a quite marginal phenomenon. In the aftermath of Charlottesville, there have been several media profiles of white supremacists. The intention, I'm sure, is to show what clear and present dangers these individuals pose to society. Given racism's dark history, I was prepared to believe it. But reading the articles, I'm struck by how pathetic and powerless these people are. Racism is only dangerous when prejudiced people have real power. It is blatantly obvious that these sorry individuals have little or no power. Something else emerges from the profiles peeping out from under the overwrought verbiage. Many of the most prominent white supremacists have a left-wing background. The Southern Poverty Law Center looked into the past of Jason Kessler, organizer of the Charlottesville rally, and was astounded to discover that he had been an Obama supporter and active in the left-wing Occupy movement. What could be more interesting than to explain how an Obama supporter could become a white supremacist, or how an Occupy Wall Street sympathizer transitioned into a defender of the white cause? Yet the progressive media went dead silent on this one. Only one local Charlottesville paper, the Daily Progress, bothered to dig into this, noting that Kessler's previous tweets, his neighbors, and several of his friends attest that he had strong liberal convictions just a few years ago. In those earlier tweets, Kessler said that not only was he a former Democrat, but many of his current followers previously voted for Democrats. David Karen, a childhood friend, said Kessler became alienated when he realized that there was no place for him in a Democratic Party focused on ethnic diversity and minority issues. In Karen's words, he was a Democrat until last year. The main thing is, he said, he felt like the party didn't want him. Laura Kleiner is a Democratic activist who dated Kessler for several months in 2013. According to the article, she said Kessler was very dedicated to his liberal principles and that he was a strict vegetarian, abstained from alcohol and drugs, embraced friends of different ethnicities, and was an atheist. Kleiner said that notwithstanding his Jewish heritage, Kessler showed no indication of being anti-Semitic. She also said that he had a roommate for several years who was an African immigrant. Speaking of Kessler, Kleiner told the newspaper, "He broke up with me, and a lot of it was because I was not liberal enough. I'm a very progressive Democrat, but he didn't like the fact that I ate fish and that I'm a Christian." I mentioned Kessler's leftist background on social media, and he lashed out angrily by releasing a video denouncing me. The video itself is rambling, incoherent, and laced with obscenities. The most interesting thing about it is that Kessler attacks me as a rich, brown-skinned guy who only stands up for big business and special interests. In other words, notwithstanding his disavowal of my portrait of him, Kessler sounds just like the left-wing racist I made him out to be. If he has undergone any kind of conversion, his video gives no indication of it. Examining other profiles of these extremists, things only get weirder. The New York Times profile Tony Hoveter, portrayed as a foot soldier of various white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups. Yet despite the paper's attempt to make Hoveter look menacing, his comments suggest a tone not so much of fanaticism as of irony. Hoveter insists, for example, that Hitler didn't necessarily want to exterminate the Jews. That was Himmler. Hitler, he claims, was a lot more kind of chill on those subjects. The problem with the diversity mongers in politics, according to Hoveter, is that at this rate, I'm sure the presidential candidate that they'll put up in a few cycles will be an overweight, black, crippled dyke with dyslexia. Hoveter interrupted one of his tirades against democracy with the aside, "I guess it seems weird when I'm talking about these types of things. You know, I'm coming at it in a mid-90s Jewish New York observational humor way." Apparently, we have a Nazi Seinfeld on our hands. And the beat goes on. Newsweek published a profile of Andrew Ornheimer, co-editor of the world's biggest neo-Nazi website, The Daily Stormer. Despite his notoriety in the United States, Ornheimer lives in the Ukraine. He fled there after serving jail time in America on a computer hacking conviction that was later vacated. In its research for the article, Newsweek interviewed Ornheimer's mother, who disclosed that her son comes from a large, mixed-raced family with Native American heritage and that he has Jewish lineage on both sides of his family. So we have a mixed-race guy who hates mixed-race people and a descendant of Jews who wants, in his words, to slaughter them like dogs. Atlantic Monthly journalist Luke O'Brien traveled to Whitefish, Montana to do an in-depth profile of the other co-editor of the Daily Stormer, Andrew Anglin. Anglin was apparently organizing a rally that he promised would include European nationalists, a Hamas representative, and a member of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. But no rally actually took place. Anglin told O'Brien that he had given up on the United States and wanted to burn it to the ground. "There is rapidly approaching a time when in every white Western city, corpses will be stacked in the streets as high as men can stack them, and you are either going to be stacking or getting stacked." Yes, we are dealing with a highly disturbed individual. But how did he get that way? O'Brien talked to Anglin's friends from the school he attended in Columbus, Ohio. They told him Anglin was a kind of hippie who enrolled in an alternative education program. Anglin was a vegan, and his girlfriend, Allison, was an animal rights activist. He was also an atheist, who wore his reddish hair in dreadlocks. His trademark hoodie bore the sign, "Fuck Racism." Anglin began his blogging career after high school. His early blogs are revealing. Here his leftist leanings were on full display. He wrote posts encouraging people to send the Westboro Baptist Church death threats from untraceable accounts, and he mocked the Ku Klux Klan and other racist organizations. Reporter O'Brien is puzzled. Anglin doesn't sound like a fascist. He sounds like a member of Antifa. In March 2007, Anglin posted about Donald Trump, attaching a video clip from a roast of former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Giuliani appears in the video in drag, and Trump rams his face into Giuliani's chest. It was all apparently in fun. Even so, Anglin describes them both as fags, and writes that Giuliani is clearly involved in a twisted homosexual transvestite affair with Donald Trump. In 2010-11, Anglin visited Southeast Asia, where he became a rainforest activist, dated Filipino women, and railed on his podcast against Christian missionaries. "You see the way white people, and it is white people, went around the world and fucked everybody. I think the white race should be bred out." This was a sentiment he routinely expressed. While O'Brien speculates that something happened in the rainforest to make Anglin a neo-Nazi, he has no idea what that might be. Neither does Anglin, apparently. So what we have is a leftist, atheist, environmentalist who thinks Trump is a fag and that white people screwed up the world running the world's largest neo-Nazi website. Go figure. Identity politics for whites. My purpose in highlighting the leftist roots of today's white supremacists is not merely to undermine the claim that they are right-wingers. It is also to show how easily people like Kessler and Anglin have morphed from leftist political activism to white supremacy. None of them underwent any conversion or transformation. Rather, they moved, as it were, laterally from leftist radicalism to neo-Nazi radicalism. The Nazis, let's recall, made precisely the same journey. Now, as in the past, leftism, racism, and neo-Nazism go hand in hand. I recognize that these ragtag extremists are a muddle-headed group. We should not, however, be muddle-headed about them. One of the few scholars to make a genuine attempt to study their movement is political scientist Carol Swain. Swain, who was featured in my film Hillary's America, is one of the leading African-American scholars in the country. Swain has written two books, a detailed study of the white nationalist movement called The New White Nationalism in America, and another consisting of searching interviews with its most prominent members. Swain recognizes that the new white nationalism, as she calls it, is different from old-style racism. Most significantly, the nationalists of today vehemently deny that they are white supremacists. They insist they are simply advocates of white identity and white power in the same mode as the advocates of black identity and black power. Incredibly, the white nationalist movement seeks to portray itself as a kind of civil rights movement, fighting for equal treatment for white people. Jared Taylor is the editor of the white nationalist website American Renaissance. An American who spent his youth in Japan, Taylor is much more urbane and cosmopolitan than we might stereotypically expect. Pointing out that minority groups often prefer to relate to members of their own group, he says, "If a white person says, 'I like being white and I prefer my associates to be white,' that's hate. Why?" Taylor adds, "Races are different. Some races are better at some things than others." Yet in his conversation with Swain, Taylor takes this line of thinking in a surprising direction. "I think Asians are objectively superior to whites by just about any measure that you can come up with. This doesn't mean I want America to become Asian. I think every people has the right to be itself. Even if Asians build societies superior to those built by white people, I think white people are perfectly legitimate in preferring the kind of societies they build." Lisa Turner, the women's coordinator of a white nationalist group called the World Church of the Creator, also insists that she is merely standing up for whites as a group, although she takes a dimmer view of Asians than Taylor. Turner tells Swain, "Asians are nothing but immigrants, copycats. It's monkey see, monkey do. They have copied what white Europeans have done, and that's the only reason Asians have any kind of civilization at all." Despite its name, the World Church of the Creator is an atheist organization, as most white nationalist groups are. "The philosophy behind Christianity," Turner says, "is utterly poisonous. Turn the other cheek, love your enemy. These kinds of ideas have put a guilt trip on the white race. The biggest enemies we have out there are the Christian churches." Swain quotes Michael Hart, who advocates a separate nation for whites somewhere in the Pacific Northwest. "I have no desire to rule over blacks or to have someone else rule over blacks on my behalf. Quite the contrary. I do not want to rule, enslave, or exterminate anyone. All that I and most white separatists want is the opportunity to rule ourselves in our own independent country." Even David Duke is on board with this approach, as suggested by the name of the group he founded, the National Association for the Advancement of White People, NAAWP. Duke says that just as the NAACP works for black interests and La Raza Unida works for Hispanic interests, his group is about preservation of our identity as ethnic people, our existence, our values, our culture, our traditions. One white nationalist that Swain did not interview is Matthew Heimbach, founder of the Traditionalist Youth Network. Although he has been dubbed the Little Führer in the media, Heimbach insists that we reject the label of any form of racial hatred. We have contact with comrades in Syria, comrades in the Philippines, comrades around the world, and black nationalists in the United States. We believe every group of people should be able to have self-determination. I can, from personal experience, verify Swain's observation that this appeal to group identity and self-determination is the language of contemporary white nationalism. In the mid-1990s, as part of my research for the end of racism, I attended an American Renaissance conference. There I heard Jared Taylor trace his intellectual lineage not to the Republican right, but to the Democratic Party and the Confederacy. His ancestors stood up for their cause and for their race, he told me, and he intended to do the same. At the conference, I also heard Sam Francis, then a columnist for the Washington Times, make an argument I had never heard anyone make in public before. What we as whites must do, he said, is reassert our identity and our solidarity, and we must do so in explicitly racial terms through the articulation of a racial consciousness as whites. The civilization that we, as whites, created in Europe and America could not have developed apart from the genetic endowments of the creating people, nor is there any reason to believe that the civilization can be successfully transmitted to a different people. I quoted Francis saying this, and the Washington Times fired him over it. Swain mentions this episode as one of the first skirmishes between a mainstream conservative, me, and a white nationalist, Francis, who had been successfully posing as a mainstream conservative. I wasn't trying to get Francis fired. I quoted his remarks because they struck me as one of the very first explicit articulations of a doctrine of white racial consciousness. Not only is Swain right that the white nationalists are not the bigots of old, but she also correctly discerns that the point they make is not entirely wrong. It takes a courageous scholar to make this point. The progressive economist Glenn Lowry is, as far as I know, the only one on the left to make it. I really don't know how you ask white people not to be white in the world we are creating, Lowry says. How are there not white interests in a world where there are these other interests? The usual progressive response to Lowry is that white solidarity is dangerous because whites as a group have the power to put their prejudices into practice. Racism is prejudice plus power, and whites supposedly have both. Black and Hispanic solidarity is not dangerous because minority groups may have their prejudices, but they don't have the accompanying power. Moreover, the motives for minority collective associations are benign. In the progressive view, disadvantaged groups have a right to form in their desire to resist white oppression and white supremacy. This argument, however, fails to consider the contemporary reality that minority interest groups are much more powerful than white nationalist groups. It's not even close. Which group has more clout, the NAACP or the NAAWP? Black representatives in Congress have a black caucus, which does not hesitate to fight for explicitly black interests. Where is the white caucus that openly promotes white interests? Moreover, black and Latino interest groups have powerful allies in Hollywood and the media. The white nationalists have none of this. They are shunned by both political parties, and they have much less power to enforce discrimination in their favor than their Latino and black counterparts. While the old-style racism is now outlawed as a consequence of civil rights legislation, affirmative action, racial preferences against whites, and in favor of blacks and other minorities is currently the law of the land. So marginalized are the white nationalist groups today that they are the ones who feel victimized. They are the ones who are branded as hate groups. Even most whites hate them. Their ideology is so controversial that on campus it sends students fleeing in search of safe spaces. The only occasion on which it is acceptable for whites to speak collectively as whites, Jared Taylor writes, is to apologize. Consequently, their racial solidarity, the white nationalists say, is a necessary response to being so besieged in mainstream culture. Both Swain and Lowry advocate that America move away from ethnic identity politics. Lowry in particular calls for a racially transcendent humanism being the American bedrock. I am on board with this, and I will discuss this further in the concluding chapter, but here I should say why white nationalists should not be expected to cheerfully go along. It is all very well to tell them that politics ideally should not be structured along the lines of race or ethnicity. Their point is, it is. And as long as the Democratic Party mobilizes groups along ethnic lines, they are going to feel justified in doing as whites what every other group does in the name of its own ethnicity. Multiculturalism has come home to roost, and white nationalists are its newest advocates. Who is Richard Spencer? I had never interviewed a white supremacist before, so I didn't know what to expect when Richard Spencer showed up to talk to me, with my film team present and the cameras rolling. Spencer is often portrayed as the most dangerous man in America. A recent profile of him in the Atlantic Monthly likened him to Hitler with the title His Kampf. And when he showed up to speak at the University of Florida, the governor declared a state of emergency. Normally, you have to be a hurricane or an epidemic to qualify for that designation. Debbie and I had arranged security. After all, we are both immigrants from third world countries, and Spencer is not known to be a fan of our type. But from the moment we saw him, we knew we had nothing to fear. Spencer came alone, unaccompanied by goons. He looked around nervously, giving me an eager-to-please smile. I saw right away he was a cordial, diffident guy. Dressed in a tweed jacket, he looked somewhat like an academic from a previous era. "No, I am not a Nazi," Spencer said right away. "I'm not a neo-Nazi. I'm not any of those things." "Why then," I asked him, "did you and your pals give the Nazi salute, the raised arm, and the Heil Trump?" At first, Spencer pretended it was no big deal. "Well, you know, we have Hail to the Chief, lots of things." But when I pressed him, he acknowledged it was for effect, a kind of up yours to the politically correct class. I was being provocative. Spencer said he wasn't a white supremacist either, but he admitted to being a white nationalist. I don't believe in nationalism in terms of silly or hokey flag-waving, and I definitely don't believe in nationalism in the sense of Europeans fighting one another. I believe, actually, in a greater brotherhood of European peoples. "Would this," I asked, "include Greeks and Italians?" Spencer said, "Yes, we are all cousins. We are all part of a big extended family." "What's so great," I asked him, "about the white race?" Spencer spoke of what he termed its Faustian spirit. The white race is expansive, whether in terms of conquering, in terms of exploration of the seas or space, or scholarship and analysis of science. We possess something that's peculiar to us, and it makes us special. "And was that something," I inquired, "in the genes?" "It is," Spencer replied. "No question. Everything is in the genes." My real interest was to find out what Spencer really believed and where he belonged on the political spectrum. I asked him whether he sought to conserve the principles of the American founding. He responded, "I've been critical of the American founding throughout my career. The whole concept of individual rights," he said, "was problematic." Me: "So all men are created equal, true or false?" Spencer: "False, obviously." Me: "The idea that we have a right to life, true or false?" Spencer: "I don't think we have rights to really anything." I asked Spencer about the two main prongs of Reaganite conservatism. Me: "One prong is American influence is good for the world, and that American power should project American values. Agree or disagree?" Spencer: "If American values are wielded to destroy other cultures and bring them into one big capitalist market or something, I don't think we should be promoting American values in that sense." Me: "The second prong of Reaganism was free market economics, promoting a global free market in which people trade with each other. Would you like to see the world be a global capitalist order?" Spencer: "Absolutely not. This notion that we need to destroy our own industries, that our people are just one more competitor in a global marketplace, good luck, sink or swim, pal, the notion that that should be our guiding philosophy of our citizens is disgusting. Actually, I totally reject that." I asked Spencer about his advocacy of a concept called the white ethnostate. Me: "What I take you to be saying is that the white ethnostate would have a powerful state at the center of it." Spencer: "No question." Me: "But this notion of limited government, as you know, the founders saw the government as the enemy of our rights." Spencer: "No individual has a right outside of a collective community. You have rights, not eternally or given by God or by nature." Me: "Who gives them to us?" Spencer: "Ultimately, the state gives those rights to you. The state is the source of rights, not the individual." Me: "Would it be fair to say you are not just against illegal immigration, but immigration period?" Spencer: "I'm definitely against illegal immigration. That's an easy one." I'm against replacement immigration in the sense that I'm against immigration coming in from the third world that is ultimately going to change the ethnic and cultural constitution of the United States. I wouldn't say I'm against immigration in itself. I would actually be happy to open the door to white South Africans among many who are truly suffering. I would be happy to take in those refugees. Me. Would you be happy with an immigration policy that said we want people from New Zealand, Australia, white guys from Europe and South Africa? We don't want people from Barbados or Bombay. Spencer, yes. And that was the immigration policy beginning in 1924 up until 1965. That period of time coincided with American greatness. Me. Now, this seems very different than Trump. Trump was quoted in the paper saying to Bannon, if there's an Indian guy working in Silicon Valley and his visa runs out and we have to send him home, that's a loss. That's something we should try to prevent. You disagree? Spencer, I do disagree with that. The H-1B visa program has been totally detrimental to white people. I want white people to become doctors, lawyers. I want white people to achieve their dreams. I asked Spencer about his favorite presidents. Reagan? I do not think he was a great president. Lincoln? Spencer blamed him for starting an unnecessary war instead of negotiating a solution with the slave owners. Spencer wasn't too hot on Washington either. Who then were his favorites? There's something about Jackson, he said. There's something about Polk, who took something from Mexico and made it ours. I pointed out to him that they were both Democrats. Finally, I asked Spencer about the movie Birth of a Nation. Me? Have you seen it? Spencer, yes, I have. Me, what did you think of it? Spencer, it's an amazing film, one of the most important films ever made. Me, leaving aside its technical merits, the notion that the sex-crazed blacks are taking over the country and the Ku Klux Klan was a redemptive movement of white identity to clean the place up, you agree with that? Spencer, it was a romanticization of the first Klan in response to Republican Reconstruction. It's an idealized vision that paints in really broad strokes. Me, but it's your music. Spencer, sure. It appealed to many Americans, including presidents. As I interviewed Spencer, I kept saying to myself, obviously this guy is not a conservative, but what is he? He's not a progressive in the contemporary sense either, and yet his ideas are so familiar. Only toward the end of the interview did it hit me. Spencer's views are virtually identical to those of the progressive racists of the Woodrow Wilson era. He even dresses the part. Basically, the guy is a relic. In a purely logical sense, Spencer should be a progressive Democrat. Progressive Democrats invented the ideology he espouses, and even today, the Democratic Party is the party of ethnic identity politics. Spencer's problem, however, is that the Democrats mobilize black, Latino, and Asian identity politics against that of whites. Since whites are now the all-round bad guy, Spencer's brand of progressivism is no longer welcome at the multicultural picnic. Thus, Spencer, a man without a party, turns to Trump. Now, there's very little on which Spencer and Trump actually agree. Trump is a flag-waving patriot who cherishes the American founders. Spencer isn't and doesn't. Trump is a capitalist. Spencer prefers a strong state regulating markets on behalf of white interests. Trump wants to keep illegals out so legal immigrants and other American citizens, whether white, black, or brown, can thrive. Spencer wants more white immigrants, fewer, if any, black and brown ones. In sum, Trump is generally conservative in his ideology, and Spencer is clearly not. Why then did Spencer vote for Trump? Why does he consider himself on the right? The simple answer is that Spencer has no place else to go, so he's trying to carve out a niche for himself in the only party where he can find some measure of agreement, however small. The point here is that Trump isn't embracing Spencer, just as Lincoln didn't embrace the know-nothings. Rather, Spencer is going to Trump, as the know-nothings eventually went to Lincoln. Look at it from Spencer's point of view. If you're a white nationalist who wants racial preferences for whites, would you rather go with the Democrats, who want racial preferences against whites, or with the Republicans, who want racial preferences for no one? Clearly the latter. If you're a white nationalist who wants to eliminate minority immigration altogether, legal and illegal, would you rather vote for the Democrats, who encourage more illegals with a view to gaining more future voters, or for the Republicans, who support legal but not illegal immigration? Again, the answer is obvious. We can see the same phenomenon on the Democratic side of the aisle. Consider a radical communist who wants a 100% tax rate and the complete abolition of private property. Would such a guy prefer the Republicans who affirm property rights and seek to lower the tax rate, or the Democrats who push for tax increases and more regulation of private property rights? Obviously the latter. Does it follow then that the Democrats are the party of communism, or that they should feel morally obligated to repudiate the communist vote? Not at all. No one even asks this of them. To sum up, white nationalism is not conservative, even if white nationalists end up in the Trump column. The left tries to portray Spencer and other white nationalists as right-wingers in the same way that they claim Hitler was a right-winger. It's an attempt to conceal their own history. Nor is white nationalism the most potent form of racism in America today. The institutionalized racism of the Democratic plantation is far worse. This is the new form of progressive ethnic exploitation that whites as a group have, at least to date, bravely resisted.